tonight we're going to be looking at really chapter 46, latter part of it, 47 and 48, and into 49. And we need to give them a caption and note three instances of this, that not only are the sons of Israel going to be delivered from famine, but the whole world is. And basically, viewed from the human standpoint, the theme is deliverance of not only the sons of Israel, but deliverance of the whole world through the wisdom of Joseph. Deliverance through wisdom. That's chapter 46, really up through 48. The theme that comes through these chapters, and we'll simply note points rather than try to outline this, the theme of the section is how Joseph worked out a good plan, how he devised a wise plan. And as a result of the wise plan, as we said, not only are the sons of Israel delivered, but they actually prosper in time of famine. And the population of the then known world is also delivered through his wisdom. And we said the section, basically in chapter 47, comes in two parts. Number one, we have Joseph having a wise plan in presenting his family. So we'll put Joseph presents, and that is in 46 verse 31 through 47:12. And the way he does it is to emphasize the need for two things: preparation to meet Pharaoh by personal introduction. Joseph goes in first. And that is in verse 31. Joseph said to his brothers, to his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh, and will say to him, quote, 'My brothers and my father's household who were in the land of Canaan have come to me, and the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have.'" Notice you have, as we pointed out this morning, two expressions here. Number one, the fact that they are shepherds, and number two, an emphasis that they are keepers of livestock. The 34th verse, remember, last part tells us why the wording needs to be careful. Last phrase says, "Every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians." So Joseph is going to say that we need to have the right wording, preparation by a personal introduction, and he is going to say, telling the truth, they are shepherds. But they are not the kind that the Egyptians loathe, which was the nomadic, wandering shepherd. And notice he emphasizes down in verse 34, that when you go in before him, you shall say, "Your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even till now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen." And the emphasis is they are shepherds, the livestock kind. And that was very important. If they were merely nomadic, wandering shepherds, and that's what the Egyptians hated about shepherds, was the fact that they roamed the whole territory, they were nomadic, and they did not like them. And so, Joseph says, "Let me go in first and prepare Pharaoh," and then second is going to be preparation by using the right words. Well-chosen words. And he is going to say, if you go in and say we're shepherds, Pharaoh is likely to loathe you. So don't do that. And again, this is part of Joseph's wisdom. Joseph knows that it is important to say the right thing in the right way and use the right words. And that's wise, coming down through the end of that chapter. With chapter 47, they get the audience with Pharaoh. Now, in 47, 1 through 7, the emphasis is on getting Pharaoh to give us Goshen. Verse 1 reads, "Then Joseph went in, told Pharaoh, and said," and he tells them that, "My father, my brothers, their flocks and their herds, and all that they have come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they're in the land of Goshen." takes five men from his brothers, presented them to Pharaoh, and they identify themselves as not only shepherds, but the particular kind that have cattle or have cattle and so forth. And they request the land. Now, question at this point, and it's part of the wisdom. Why did they need to go in this chapter and ask Pharaoh for Goshen? Number one, Joseph was the administrator of the land, and all he had to do was take it. He did not have to ask permission. Second, if you go back to chapter 45, verse 17, Pharaoh had already said, take your pick. Chapter 45, verse 17, Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this, load your beasts, go to the land of Canaan, take your father, your households, and come to me, and I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you shall eat the fat of the land. Now you are ordered, do this, take wagons from the land of Egypt, and your little ones, and and for your wives, and bring your father and come. Do not concern yourself with your goods, for the best of the land of Egypt is yours. In other words, don't load up and bring everything from Canaan. I'll give you everything you need here. Now, let's suppose you were an administrator, public administrator like Joseph. Why do you think in chapter 47 he takes the time to go in and request this land of Pharaoh when, number one, Pharaoh's already said, take the best, and second, he is in a position to take the best? Why didn't he do it? Why does he wait to get his further approval? Want to make that through? If you're a public administrator and you were to be fair and just, if Joseph went in and took everything that Pharaoh said take, the best of the land, what would he have been open to? He would have been open to the criticism of being playing favorites with his family. And therefore, he wants to be sure that this is not perceived by people as I went in and I took. I want Pharaoh to give it by proclamation to me, and that is part of the wisdom, again, of Joseph. You've got another example in verses 11 and 12 of primary and secondary cause. Says Joseph settled his father and his brothers, and again, Joseph is the subject of all of this, gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had ordered. Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with food according to their little ones. And here is another one of those good examples of primary, secondary cause. Keeping your finger here, notice in this passage, it is Joseph that provides salvation. However, go to Psalm 105. The sons of Israel are settled. They prosper and do well. And it is because they're in the land of Goshen, because they put forth effort with their cattle. But all of that is secondary to the primary cause. Psalm 105, 16. And this is a part of the psalm that should always be studied and read along with the life of Joseph. Verse 16, he called, this is God, he called for a famine upon the land. He broke the staff, whole staff of bread. He sent a man before them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. They afflicted his feet with fetters. He himself was laid in irons. That's doubtless a prophecy, or a comment on the time spent in jail because of Potiphar's wife. Until the time that his word came to pass, the word of the Lord tested him. The king sent, released him, rulers of the people set him free, made him lord of his house, ruler over all his possessions, to imprison his princes at will, that he might teach his elders wisdom. Notice the emphasis is Joseph was recognized for his great wisdom. Israel also came into Egypt. That's where we are now. Thus Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. He caused his people to be very fruitful, made them stronger than their adversaries. So really, this little setting of Psalm 105, 16 through 24, is interpreting the events in the life of Joseph from his selling into Egypt, clear down to bringing Jacob and the family down to Egypt. It sets the primary cause for all of this and the way we ought to interpret it. Now, one last thing. Go over to chapter 47. If only we would observe the kind of welfare that Joseph provided, things would be so much better. And basically, in the last part, Joseph provides food for all. Basically, the food is provided through the Egyptian administration, through the government, and that's in 1327. And the thing to note is that the people will come along and say, Joseph, we have no money to buy any more grain with. We've spent it all. And Joseph says, well, if you don't have any money, we'll just give it to you. Very important point. Joseph never provided one grain of wheat without requiring payment. Joseph, in his administration of the food for the people of the world, Joseph never provided without requiring some kind of compensation. Joseph never provided without requiring some kind of compensation on the part of those with whom he supplied the grain. Or let's put it this way, no handouts. No handouts. Only, well, can we coin a word? Earnouts. No handouts. Only earnouts. Now let's note the way that works. Chapter 47, verse 15. Have you ever noticed how our country, we give and give and give, and the nations to whom we give always are so grateful to us, are they not? No, they hate us. And they hate us because we don't do things the Joseph way. Joseph would never give it away. He would require some kind of compensation. And I'm sure if someone came to Joseph's door and said, I am bereft of food. I need food. Can you give me some? Joseph said, absolutely, in return for cutting the yard. And that's the way he does in all of his beneficent, we might call it intelligent benevolence. Benevolence can be very stupid, or benevolence can be intelligent. His was intelligent. And let's notice that coming down to chapter 47, verse 15. And when the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us food. Why should we die in your presence? Our money is gone. Joseph said, give up your livestock, and I will give you food for your livestock since your money is gone. So if you can't give money, he took their livestock. So, verse 17, they brought their livestock to Joseph. Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses, the flocks, and the herds, and the donkeys, and fed them with food in exchange for all their livestock that year. And then notice what happened. Verse 18, when that year was ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, we will not hide from my lord that our money is all spent. The cattle are my lord's. There is nothing left for my lord except our bodies and our lands. Why, verse 19, should we die before your eyes? Both we and our land, buy us and our land for food, and we and our land will be slaves to Pharaoh. So give us seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not be desolate. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For every Egyptian sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. Thus the land became Pharaoh's. Notice how it works. Joseph never provided without requiring compensation. There were no handouts. And let's term that intelligent benevolence. Intelligent benevolence. Now, is that a New Testament principle? Go over to the book of 1 Timothy, chapter 5. And for some reason, the widows were in need. Well, obvious reason, the widows were in need. And the interesting thing is that as Paul gives instruction about how to take care of the widows, notice down at verse 9 how this was intelligently organized. Let a widow be put on the list. We really don't know what that list was. The church had some kind of list and in some way provided for certain widows. Let a widow be put on the list only. Notice the qualifiers. Only if she's not less than 60 years old. And the only goes with all of these. Only if she has been the wife of one man. Only if she has a reputation for good works. And only if she has brought up children. If she has shown hospitality to strangers. If she's washed saints' feet. How would you like to meet the requirements for getting on the widowhood list? I mean, you'd have, there's some doing to it. This is intelligent benevolence. If she's assisted those in distress. That means if she was the kind of person that's lived her entire life selfishly, I see no reason to put her on the list. If she lives selfishly, then she doesn't deserve to be on the list. And if she has devoted herself to every good work, but refused to put younger widows on the list, and so forth and so forth. And all through here, you have these requirements. And basically, the teaching of the passage then, with all the requirements for being on the list, is in the church, there ought to be benevolence, and it ought to be smart benevolence. It ought to be intelligent benevolence. All right, going back then to Genesis. Just to check ourselves out, when we read through here with Joseph about eventually taking their land and everything in exchange for food, do you get a little twinge of, Joseph, aren't you a little bit hard-nosed? You know why you get that twinge? Because of the culture in which we live. And therefore, we're all very much affected by the bleeding heart mentality. Now, there's another principle that is involved. Notice in chapter 47, as a result, the people were grateful. Look down at chapter 47 and verse, is it 47:25. So they, the people, said, "You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's slaves." The people were grateful. Now, can we put down, can we determine, why is it that when there is a giving in a welfare sense without allowing the person somehow to earn it, why does that make people hate us when that happens? And we can see it on the national scene. Very important thing. To give without requiring compensation. To give without requiring compensation steals dignity and self-dependence or self-reliance. And I mean self-reliance in a good sense. To give without requiring compensation steals dignity and self-reliance. And thus breeds hatred. Is it not true when you are given something which you could truly and honestly earn that you have been made dependent upon the giver rather than dependent upon yourself? So that while Joseph was very good in giving, they could also say, "We earned it." To give without requiring compensation steals dignity and self-reliance and thus breeds hatred. And we can see the example of it many, many, many times. And that does not mean we ought not to be benevolent. It means our benevolence ought to be intelligent, as 1 Timothy 5 prescribes and as Joseph gives as an example there. Wouldn't Joseph have been good at health and human resources in the United States? He wouldn't have lasted at all, but the people loved him for it, and he supplied for them, and they had their dignity. They could just as often say to Joseph, "Joseph, you've provided for us, but Joseph, we earned it, and therefore we're not Egypt dependent, We are self-dependent. We have earned it. Very important principle. Okay, now let's take up a little time and see some of the very remarkable prophecies about Jacob and his sons. And that's going to be chapter 49, but let me say a few things on the way to that. When we come to chapter 47, the last part of the chapter, on through chapter 48, down to about the end of chapter 48, this is a beginning of narratives about the death and burial of Jacob. And many times throughout the Joseph narrative, there is mention about anticipating death. And one of the things we want to go back and trace through is that Jacob died so much better than he ever thought he would. Go back to chapter 37. In chapter 37, Jacob begins to talk about his death. And he anticipates that he's going to go to the grave in sorrow. It's what he thinks is going to happen. Chapter 37, verse 25. This, of course, is all over the what he thinks is the death of I'm looking at the wrong passage, aren't I? 35, sorry. He has received the news that Joseph has been killed. And in verse 35, all his sons, all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "Surely I will go down to the grave in mourning for my son." So he was positive he was going to go to the grave in sorrow. Chapter 42, verse 38. This theme continues when he is requested to send Benjamin down to Egypt. Jacob said, verse 38, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you are taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to the grave in sorrow." He anticipated a sorrowful death. Chapter 44. 44:22. The brothers report that "We have said to my Lord, the lad cannot leave his father, for he should leave his father would die." He expected to go to the grave in sorrow. Same thing down at verse 29. "If you take this one from me, harm befalls him, you will bring my gray hair down to the grave in sorrow." And that's what he anticipated. However, if we go to chapter 45, things get better because he now meets Joseph and finds that he is alive. 45:28. "Upon meeting Joseph, Israel said, 'This is enough. My son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die.'" 46:30. "Then Israel said to Joseph, 'Now let me die, since I have seen your face, that you're still alive.'" So he had anticipated going to the grave in sorrow. He meets Joseph, and he says, "That's good enough. I won't have to go in the sorrow that I anticipated that I would. I've seen you. I am ready to die." But that's not all. Chapter 48, verse 11. Israel said to Joseph, as Ephraim and Manasseh are brought in, Israel said to Joseph, "I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your children as well." In other words, I didn't expect to see my son, much less my grandsons. And so notice how things turn out so much better for Jacob than he had really anticipated. All right, now let's go to 49. As Jacob looks back now over his life, he gathers his children in. Verse 1, "Jacob summoned his sons and said, 'Assemble yourselves that I may tell you what shall befall you in the days to come.'" In other words, he's going to look at Reuben and say, "Reuben, here is going to be a prophecy of what this part of the nation will be like. And what we want to do with these brothers is notice how the prophecy about Reuben was fulfilled. And we'll try to get, if we can, down as far or through Judah tonight. His days are over. As far as he is concerned, he anticipates nothing for himself, but he does see great things ahead for his sons, which is the subject of these 27 verses. These boys had been born over 23 years to four different wives, and they make up the founding fathers of the nation of Israel. So really, Genesis 49 is prophetic insight to the history of Israel. Jacob and his sons, or prophetic insight into the history of the Jewish people. Prophetic insight into the history of the nation. He is going to tell them the way the nation is going to go, and he is going to be specific about each tribe. Basically, as the sons stand in front of Jacob, Jacob is given the prophetic insight to say to Reuben and Simeon, here's what is ahead for you, here is what is going to happen. Most of these prophecies here are fulfilled by the time we get to the book of Judges. That'd be about 600 or 700 years. So the things he says to these brothers are going to look forward for about 700 years. The only exception to that is Judah. And Judah, prophecy concerning him, begins to be fulfilled in the time of David, and the complete fulfillment takes place with the birth of Jesus. So let's take, then, each one of them, starting with Reuben. Basically, Reuben contributed nothing. The only thing Reuben contributed in the history of Israel is the name for a very good sandwich. Outside of that, Reuben didn't do much of anything. So, notice the prophecy. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity, preeminent in power, uncontrolled as water. Or if you have a King James, you probably have unstable as water. You shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. So Reuben, then, the basic idea is he will be, or that tribe will be, uncontrolled, unstable, and the word also is used in the sense of rebellion against God's order. Uncontrolled, unstable, rebellious in regard to God's established order. And we'll want to see in the history of the tribe of Reuben how this occurs. Go to Numbers 16. Oh, pardon me, the event we need to go and refer to in chapter 49. The reason that Reuben will never be in a place of leadership is said to be in the last part of verse 4, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defile it, he went up to my couch. Keep your finger there and go back to chapter 35 for the incident. Well, I'm doing well tonight, aren't I? Okay, that's it. And it came about that while Israel was dwelling in that land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. Now, as far as we know, he didn't do anything about it. He just heard of it. He knew about it. Apparently, the sons never knew until chapter 49 in Genesis when the last blessing is being... Why do we say that, going back to that passage? Because you, addressing him, went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. Not you, but he went up to my couch. In other words, this is probably a revelation to the brothers that they had never known before. And as a result of that, he will never amount to anything. All right, now let's go to Numbers chapter 16. For a first instance of the fulfillment of the rebellion of the tribe of Reuben against God's order. Chapter 16. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram. Dathan and Abiram are two Reubenites. Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took action. They rose up before Moses, together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown. They assembled themselves together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You've gone far enough. All the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" And so the descendants down the line of Reuben gather in rebellion against God's order, just as prophesied. Numbers 32. Numbers 32. One through five. When it's time in God's plan to cross the Jordan, everybody was willing except Reuben wanted an exception. Verse 1. The sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad had an exceedingly large number of livestock. So when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, that it was indeed a place suitable for livestock, the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben came and spoke to Moses and Eleazar the priest and to the leaders of the congregation, saying, these following places, verse 4, "The land which the Lord conquered before you, before the congregation of it, is a land for livestock. Your servants have livestock." And they said, "If we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession. Do not take us across the Jordan." In other words, they plead to be the exception to God's order that you're going to cross the Jordan into the promised land. That's a typical Reuben mentality. Judges 5. Judges 5. This is called the Song of Deborah and Barak. And they're talking about when the nation went into the land, that the people were willing, they volunteered, and Deborah and Barak sing their praises. Verse 1, "Deborah and Barak, the son of Hinnom, sang on that day, saying, that the leaders in Israel, led in Israel, that the people volunteered, bless the Lord." And he goes down and he recites how the people responded and how they volunteered for battle, until you come down to chapter 5 and verse 16. I'll skip to verse 15. "The princes of Issachar were with Deborah. As was Issachar, so was Barak. Into the valley they rushed at his heels. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. Question, Reuben, why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the piping for the flocks? Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart." And that is a criticism. Why is it when every other tribe went into the battle, you wouldn't leave your sheep? Indecisive, unstable in every sense of the word. Reuben never prospered as a tribe. They never prospered as a tribe. And you can see that by looking at two censuses that were taken and how the tribe of Reuben diminished. Numbers 1, you have a census in Numbers 1, you have another census in Numbers 26. And you find a tribe such as Judah grew. Reuben did not. Reuben diminished. You compare Numbers chapter 1, verse 20. Verse 20 says, "The sons of Reuben, Israel's firstborn," and you have their numbered men, in verse 21 as 46,500. 26:7 of the same book. 26:7. These are the families of the Reubenites, and those who were numbered of them were 43,730. So notice they have diminished, and that is the story of that particular tribe. In fact, later on in the book of Deuteronomy, things get bad enough that Moses prays, and in Deuteronomy 33:6 he says, "May the tribe of Reuben not diminish." And they were doing just that. Now, the final note here is this. Reuben did not produce one prophet. Not even one. Reuben did not contribute even one military leader. Reuben did not contribute one judge. There were no great men in the tribe of Reuben. Absolutely nothing. No leadership, no great men, because of her instability. Leadership doesn't come from the unstable. Look at James chapter 1 is a good illustrated here. James 1. Verse 8. Being a double-minded man, unstable in all of his ways. And that is the comment on Reuben in the Old Testament. Next, come two together, Simeon and Levi. Simeon and Levi. And that is Genesis 49, 5 through 7. 49, 5 through 7. Simeon and Levi are brothers. I hope you have a question there. Obviously they are brothers. They were the sons of Jacob by Leah, the second and third sons. So I take it Jacob must have more in mind than just saying the obvious, you two fellows are brothers. I take it that probably what he had in mind is in terms of outlook and interest, they are very similar. Simeon and Levi are brothers. They're very similar, both born to Jacob and Leah. And notice they engaged in violence. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in anger they slew men. And in their self-will, they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Now, the interesting thing about the two things here are, number one, what was their crime? What did they do that was so violent? And second, when the land is portioned out to the various tribes, you wouldn't expect Simeon and Levi to get any portion, because they are simply going to be scattered and dispersed throughout all Israel. And we'll find out in the book of Joshua a remarkable fulfillment of just that. Because neither Simeon or Levi ever got any land. Neither one of them did, as prophesied by Jacob. Now, what had they done that was so violent? Genesis 34. And while we must take this seriously as violent and very much criticized by the Word of God, you'll have to admit there is a little bit of humor in chapter 34. In chapter 34, their sister, Dinah, now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. So the sister is raped. However, Shechem falls very much in love with her. And you come down to verse 8. Hamor spoke with him, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage."
and intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters to you. Then you shall live with us. The land shall be open before you live and trade and acquire property in it. And coming down to verse 14, a condition is made. Jacob's son says to him, "We cannot do this thing. We cannot give our sister to you to marry. We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition we will consent to you. If you will become like us, and that every male of you be circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people." And so the agreement, right or wrong, is made. At least it is an agreement. And we come down to verse 25. They follow through with the circumcision. Verse 25, it came about on the third day when they, that is the circumcised Canaanites, were in pain, that two of Jacob's sons said, "Let's attack." And so Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword, came upon the city unawares, and killed every male. In other words, they were unable, because of the pain, to defend themselves, and they killed them. Now, they did this in the name of righteousness. Verse 31, they said, Jacob says at verse 30 what has happened. Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought me trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men being few in number. They will gather together against me and attack me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my household." But they said, "Reuben and Simeon, shall he treat our sister as a harlot?" And so that is the event that Jacob is referring to over in chapter 49, and it is the reason why neither Levi nor Simeon either get any land in the apportionment under Joshua. Now let's see that fulfillment. Joshua 1 through 12 describes the conquest of Canaan. Joshua 13 on through 21 records the division of the land. And if you go to Joshua chapter 19, you have the fulfillment of what Jacob had prophesied. Joshua 19. Verse 1. "Then the second lot fell to Simeon, to the tribe of the sons of Simeon, among their families. And their inheritance was in the midst of the inheritance of the sons of Judah." They didn't get any of their own. So they had as their inheritance Beersheba, and he names, I think, something like 17 cities. And then you come down to verse 9. "The inheritance of the sons of Simeon was taken from the portion of the sons of Judah, for the share of the sons of Judah was too large for them. So the sons of Simeon received an inheritance in the land in the midst of Judah's inheritance." Simeon didn't get her own, and just as was prophesied, she was scattered. In the census of Numbers 1 and Numbers 26, Reuben loses, if I recall correctly, something like 20,000 people. They simply fade off the pages. Numbers 35. Now Levi does not get land either. And 35, 1 through 4 of Numbers notes that. "Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho, saying, 'Command the sons of Israel that they give to the Levites from the inheritance of their possession cities to live in. You shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities, and the cities shall be theirs to live in, and their pasture lands shall be for their cattle and for their herds and for their beasts.'" And so notice in the distribution of the land, they do not get any. Joshua 21. Joshua 21. They did not get land they got cities. Verse 41, all the cities of the Levites in the midst of the possession of the sons of Israel were 48 cities with their pasture land. So they got cities and suburbs, but just as was predicted by Jacob, they do not get anything in a strict sense of the word. Now we'll pick up next time with Judah. Judah is going to be probably the most important. More is said about Judah than any other tribe. And basically he's going to say, Judah, you'll be a leader, you'll be a conqueror, you're going to produce kings, and Judah, you will produce the Messiah. We'll pick up with that point. And I think I have to revise, we probably will not get started with Titus. I believe we're going to need two more sessions in Genesis. So whenever we get there. Father, thankful for your word, for the prophecies made by Jacob and their accurate fulfillment in Christ's name.